Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
What a beautiful afternoon. Hi, everybody. It's Alan Mitchell, Low Tide, and it is a gorgeous day in Edmonton, hopefully where you are as well. Lots to talk about today, a jam-packed show, as they say. We are Nation Radio. Our focus is Oilers past, present, and future, plus the NHL's biggest stories every week. And you can email us at nationradio@theteam1260.com. Our guests today will include, in the first hour, James Myrtle from the Globe and Mail. We'll talk about the Stanley Cup playoffs, the World Hockey Championships, and check out the draft and news around the league. Terry Jones from the Edmonton Sun will be by in hour two. We'll talk Stanley Cup playoffs, the Oilers offseason, and a few other items. Greg Drinnen from Taking Note will be by in hour number one as well. Oliver Gabriel, a Columbus prospect, will talk about the draft, and just confirmed a little while ago, Brian Sutherby will be joining us at the top of hour two. That's about an hour from right now, and we'll talk about his experience, not necessarily at the draft or after the draft, but leading up to the draft, through Midget, a very well-known hockey player in our area, and went to Moose Jaw, played his junior in the Dub, and then obviously went a long way towards becoming a first-round draft pick with WHL's Moose Jaw Warriors. We'll talk to him about that, the combine, and more in hour number two. A few major items in the National Hockey League to get to today. If you haven't heard, late last night, news broke that New York Rangers forward Derek Bougard passed away. No cause of death was mentioned in the statement that was released by the New York Rangers late last night. According to the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Bougard was found dead last night in his Minneapolis apartment by members of his family. And no confirmation of cause of death and nothing really to talk about beyond the fact that it is obviously a tragedy. And the NHL community on Drinnen's blog, Taking Note, there's lots of comments from NHLers and people associated with the game. Great outpouring for an obviously good guy, Derek Bougard, passed away last night. In the World Hockey Championships, Finland and Sweden will play for a gold tomorrow. The Finns defeated Russia yesterday, and the Swedes down the Czechs to get to the finals again, the gold medal game. It's on TSN tomorrow, both games, as a matter of fact. Finland won their only World Hockey Championship in 1995. Sweden isn't an annual winner, but they win a few times, quite often, eight times. The most recent one is 2006. And the 2006 theme will come up quite a bit today as we talk about the National Hockey League semifinals. The Tampa Bay-Boston series gets underway tonight, game one of the Eastern Conference Final. I guess it's going to come down. I think the goaltending is fairly even. Rolison, who we're familiar with, his great run through to the finals in 2006 for Tampa Bay, and Tim Thomas, who might be the most valuable player in the NHL, but right now I think it's pretty much even, Steven. The Tampa Bay Club is a team that has great coaching, and they clog up the neutral zone, much like McTavish and the Oilers did in 2006 against Detroit. It's an interesting system, and it will be fun to watch Boston try to break through that with all of those power forwards. I think it's going to be a fun series, but I think Boston should have the edge there. And then tomorrow night, San Jose-Vancouver, the other Final Four matchup, and the Western Final should be a long one. I think it goes seven, although the question marks for Vancouver are the same, I think, for San Jose, except bigger. You know, there are some question about the goaltending in Vancouver, with Luongo being a little inconsistent. I think the question mark is even bigger in San Jose. And in Vancouver, the Sedins are being questioned, how much they're bringing, whether they're injured, and some of the depth scoring. And I think the same thing could be said about San Jose. Danny Heatley hasn't done a lot for the Sharks in their series so far. And so it's going to be interesting to see exactly how that breaks down. I think both are going to be deep series, but my picks are Boston and Vancouver. It hurts me to say that, in the final. And we'll talk to our guests about that today and get their picks as well. What a great Western Hockey League playoff this was. It ended last night. Kootenay wins the WHL championship over Portland. Lots of draft eligibles on the Winterhawks, and a team that just would not quit. You heard the pipeline guys talking about Eakin, and just incredible things that went on for Kootenay and for them to win the championship again and off to the Memorial Cup. That's going to be fun. And the Islanders signed Michael Grabner, five-year deal, $3 million a season. That is after one good season. It was a great season, but his rookie year gets him that contract. That is wild. Very interesting stuff to talk about today. So we look forward to that and more throughout the day. As I mentioned to you, we've got a very interesting show. Looking forward to talking to Brian Sutherby, who'll be joining us in just a little while from right now, about an hour or so. And we'll be talking to James Myrtle in just two shakes here. Also, if we get time today, I did want to pass along a little bit of information about the top 10 and how you can get involved. We're going to do a special promotion here at Nation Radio. radio about, we want your top 10 overall, your predictions. You can send them to us. Email them anytime, nationradio@theteam1260.com. We'll collect them. And those who get the closest, we're going to give away a great prize. Wouldn't mind your suggestions about what prize you'd like, whether it's an autographed Oiler jersey or whatever the case may be. Love to get a hold of that and love to get your input on what you'd like to win if you do win the top 10 overall. You have to get them all right, and those that do, it's interesting because the top 8 I think everybody's going to nail in maybe not the right order, but I think the top 8 are pretty much widely known, and then number 9 and number 10 are going to be the I think probably the big question marks as we move forward. I have my own list that I'll be publishing a little bit later on, either today or tomorrow morning on Oilers Nation blog, and it's going to be interesting to see that 9 and 10 group, because the top 8, as I say, they're pretty much, you know, spot on. After that, it's looking pretty interesting. A few emails from last week that I wanted to pass along to you while we have an opportunity here. This comes from Christopher. Says, longtime fan. Living in Norway, I follow the World Hockey Championships. A player that really impressed an intriguing Norwegian squad is Anders Bastiansen. Big, gritty center, 6 feet, 215. Extreme in the World Championship play in the cycle. Does very well in the cycle. Behind the goal against strong competitors like Canada, the U.S., Sweden, and Finland. Impressing 7 points in 7 days, 4 goals and 3 assists. Just what the doctor ordered. Great face-off skills. Good on the PK. He was the MVP in the Swedish playoff for Färjestad. Impressed with fellow journeyman Marius Holtet, especially in the finals. And although he's 29, I think he's worth a further look as a fourth line center. And that will be interesting as they wrap up the World Hockey Championships. The kid that I want, not a kid, but the guy I want him to check out is the goaltender Fast. I think he'll be an interesting possible signing for the Edmonton Oilers, and no doubt some NHL team will pick him up. Well, let's get the show started, and we welcome from the Globe and Mail, Mr. James Myrtle. How are you, James?
I'm great, Alan. How are you doing?
Good. You're in Toronto?
Yeah.
How's the weather out there?
It's awful. I don't know what it's like in Edmonton. We've had the worst May since I've lived here, which is about 8 years. It's been ugly.
You know, we've had an unbelievably bad spring, but it's really nice now. You know, we finally arrived, so hopefully the good weather will come to you. Every day I visit your Globe and Mail site, and last night I got home from work and I dropped by and I saw the craziest goal from Michael Granlund. Wow. The play-by-play guy for the Finnish broadcast started speaking in tongues, and I think it was worth it.
Yeah, if people haven't seen that, you know, log on to our site. It's one of those sort of lacrosse-type goals from behind the net, but it's even more impressive because Granlund, who plays for Finland and was in the semifinals yesterday against Russia, essentially he beats out two Russian defenders, strips one of the puck, goes around another, and then in one fluid motion puts the puck on his stick and sort of puts it in from the goal line, basically. And no one on the ice was expecting this, so it was just incredible. And Granlund's a really high draft pick last year by the Minnesota Wild, and he looks like a guy that has sort of the skill level that he's going to be able to contribute at the NHL, because I think he's only 19 or 20 years old right now.
I can't remember the last time I saw a goal scored where the opposition and the team that scored the goal were all kind of in shock.
Yeah, the look on the faces of the Russian players was like, no one can stop that. You know, like I think they were thinking, we all played that perfectly, and there was no way we could prevent what he just did. I mean, it was incredible. I think it was the best goal of the year. You know, I had some people on Twitter saying to me that, oh, these goals are getting old or whatever. But this one wasn't a guy sort of with a lot of time behind the net and sort of standing motionless and slowly putting it on a stick and then putting it in the net, which we've seen in other leagues before. This was impressive. You know, it was at full speed. And as you said, you know, the Finnish announcer, we have no idea what he was saying, but he was pretty excited.
He was. There's some fallout for Canada from the World Hockey Championships. Bob Nicholson went public yesterday saying he's dissatisfied with the Canadian team finishing outside the medals again. I find it interesting. It seems to me, as an outsider looking in, some NHL teams really devote a lot to this, send their young players, want their guys to get the experience. Some possibly not as much. Is that what he's sort of pointing out there, or what do you think that he'd like to improve for next year?
I know that last year, I think they finished 7th or 8th last year when Marc Messier was the GM, and just sort of the scuttlebutt around that team a year ago was they were really, really unhappy with how things went. The number of players that went was really subpar. The goaltenders that they had were, you know, no offense to guys like Chad Johnson, the backup for, or the former backup for the New York Rangers, but the goaltenders just weren't the elite caliber. And I think this year they made a really, really strong push to get a much better team. And I think they succeeded. You know, I thought the forwards that they had over there this year were fantastic. You know, you had guys like Travis Zajac playing on the third or fourth line, and it was a really deep team at forward. They could have used a couple more good defensemen, I think, because, you know, someone like Mark Methot was playing quite a bit. But, you know, it's one of those things. They were pretty dominant in the tournament all the way through, and I think the format is a little bit goofy that they had to play Russia in their first elimination game after winning every single other game. You know, I don't know if they should get that discouraged about that, but they had the best team in the tournament, so I can see why Bob Nicholson's upset.
Yeah, and I think also the fact is they lost on two specific plays. One where Spezza didn't, obviously on the power play, didn't fall back, and then he missed the puck, and then the Russian forward scored on the shorthanded goal. And then I don't know about the coverage on Kovalchuk, but you'd think he'd be the one guy you'd be paying attention to.
Yeah, and you know, one of them was a Dion Phaneuf brain cramp, which we've seen a lot in Toronto. So you know, I don't know. I think that there were a lot of positives in that tournament, a lot more than last year. You know, last year was just an abomination, and it sort of, I think it showed that Hockey Canada needs to take that tournament a little bit more seriously last year, and I think they did this year, and I think they sent a really, really good team. And you know, when it comes down to one of those one-game winner-take-all, sometimes you can lose it.
Let's change subjects and talk about what I think everybody is interested in, the Stanley Cup semifinals, but specifically the Vancouver Canucks. Are people in Toronto behind the Canucks, or is it like, okay, well, they're in? What's the feeling in Toronto about the Canucks? James? I think we've lost James. We'll get James back. The reason I wanted to ask him that question was, you know, in Edmonton, I don't think it's even split even. I think Oiler fans are at a point where it's like, okay, they're in, let's cheer for San Jose. I think if you did a poll, as the Nation Radio or the Oilers Nation folks did not long ago, there was a distinct feeling that, you know what, we'll cheer for San Jose now because, you know, I think it's just too much. Maybe we can only have one Canadian team from the West go to the finals a decade that's not named the Oilers. We went through that with the Calgary Flames before the lockout in 04, and now it's a matter of we can't possibly get behind the Canucks because, you know what, it's too painful. But I think there's a lot of sense among Edmontonians and Oilers fans specifically that's something that isn't going to happen. The Canucks may win, but I don't think there's a whole Canadian group who's really getting behind as far as Edmonton and maybe Alberta. I don't know. I haven't talked to a lot of Flames fans, but it seems to me that's something that maybe Toronto will feel a little bit differently about. We'll find out from James if we can get him back. Also, just want to talk a little bit about back to the World Hockey Championships and Bob Nicholson. I didn't bring it up with James, but we will in possibly before the end of the interview, talking a little bit about the fact that the Edmonton Oilers have, over the years, and this goes back to Ryan Smith and before, really spent a lot of time sending players, often younger players, but even the veterans, to the World Hockey Championships. And the Calgary Flames seem to be an organization, and maybe it's because they're veterans and they're banged up by the end of the season, but the Flames seem less likely to send their big stars, and that's like Aginla and Regier and all of those guys over the years. Seems as though if it's the Olympic year, then totally, they're all over it. But if they're not in the Olympic year, it's not necessarily something that the Calgary Flames organization has got behind, and that's unusual because a lot of the training goes on in Calgary, and there's the big Olympic site there, and you would think that would definitely be something that they're more interested in doing, but from what I can tell, teams like Toronto and Edmonton and maybe even Montreal are more devoted to that Team Canada and making sure that everybody gets out than some of the other teams in the National Hockey League. James is back with us. How do people in Toronto feel about the Canucks and their run to the Stanley Cup Finals?
I think it's sort of split opinion. You know, there's a big group of people that jump on board anytime a Canadian team goes deep in the playoffs, and I think a lot of people just want to see the drought ended for any Canadian team. But then there, you know, it's probably 50-50, and then the other 50%, you know, are sort of anti other Canadian teams a little bit, and they really just want the Leafs to win. So I think it's sort of all over the place.
Now that those green men have gotten the attention of Nicole Kidman, do you think there's going to be a lot of green men showing up at Vancouver for the games?
Well, I was waiting for that to happen in the second round, and I didn't see that many other people doing it. You know, if you think about it, I think the level of commitment you need to put one of those things on, you know, I've seen interviews with those guys where they talk about it, and they can't drink beer during the game, and they can't eat anything, and things like that. You know, maybe the level of commitment needed to do that is just too high that other people aren't going to jump on board.
It'd have to be a lot for me to give up beer during a hockey game.
Yeah.
Looking at San Jose and Vancouver, I was mentioning at the top of the show, I see the problems that maybe Vancouver has with the Sedins maybe underperforming and maybe a slight question in goal with Luongo's consistency. Are the same questions with San Jose only greater with Heatley? And Niemi has beaten, you know, a lot of teams. I don't know the last time that he lost a playoff series, if he ever has in the NHL. But there are some questions about San Jose. How do you see that series playing out?
You know, at the beginning of the playoffs, I picked San Jose to get over the hump and win the cup, so I'm going to stick with them, but I think this is going to be a long series. I think it's going to be really competitive. San Jose's biggest strength is their depth at forward, more than any other Sharks team. Even if Heatley and Marleau get shut down, which they were in the second round, even if that happens, they've got the depth there. They've got Logan Couture. They've got Klo playing really well. Setoguchi's playing well. They've got Pavelski centering the third line. I mean, at center ice, they're deeper than any team in the NHL. So that's their strength is up front. On defense, there's a little bit of weakness there. You know, I think the top pairing is really good, but the second and third pairing aren't the elite caliber. And Niemi is a little bit of a question mark because he's been very, very average this year, maybe even a little bit below average. So the goaltending is going to be a big part of this. I don't think anyone really knows what we're going to get out of Niemi and what we're going to get out of Luongo in this series, and it might decide it right there.
Yeah, and it's funny because in the other series out east, the goaltending is like it is locked down solid on both sides. And I'm wondering, I'm just trying to think in my mind about the Tampa Bay defense, the 1-3-1, with Boston's big power forwards, are they just going to shoot the puck in and mash the defenseman? Is that a strategy that might work?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and Tampa's defense is a little bit beat up. They got a lot of big guys, but they're not the fastest team out there. They miss Pavel Kubina. That's a pretty big loss for them because then all of a sudden their second pairing is Brett Clark is one of the guys out there, and it's really not the kind of defense core that you think would win a championship. But you know, if they get healthy, if they get Pavel Kubina back, I think they're a little bit better than they were even in the second round. But yeah, I think you're right. I think the way Boston, a lot of people don't know this, but Boston was the highest scoring team at 5-on-5 in the regular season. So that's their bread and butter is even strength play. And the Lightning are completely the opposite, where they do most of their scoring on the power play. So it's really going to be a battle of can Boston score a lot of goals 5-on-5 by doing, as you said, trying to get through the 1-3-1. And can Boston's penalty kill stop a power play that is so elite because of obviously the guys that the Lightning can put out on there?
Let's change gears a little bit. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about something you wrote, I think it was last week, about the Atlanta Thrashers and their ownership. And if it was this week, I apologize. It's come to the fore now with that ridiculous interview before an NBA game this week that the Thrashers are not the same as the Coyotes in terms of ownership and in terms of how stubbornly the local area is going to hold on to the franchise.
Yeah. No, it was last week, yeah. And it turned out I was a little bit ahead of the curve there by a couple of days because the sort of real interest in the Atlanta Thrashers has picked up a ton the past couple of days. And, you know, you had one of the co-owners of the Thrashers come out, Bruce Levinson. I think one of the things people need to know about Levinson is that there are basically seven owners of the Thrashers, and half of them, three of the guys, aren't even based in Atlanta. They're based in Washington. And this was sort of like originally it was nine people that were in this ownership group. They were in three different cities. And I think the guys that aren't in Atlanta, they're not that concerned about the team staying in Atlanta. They're basketball fans. They want to own an NBA franchise. The hockey franchise just sort of came with it when they bought the team. And they've essentially been trying to sell the Thrashers almost since they bought the team. The problem is that litigation sort of held up the ownership group, and they weren't able to sell. So now that they're able to sell, they want to get rid of it, and it's going to be really hard to sell just the hockey team and hold on to the arena rights and hold on to the basketball team because no one's going to want to buy just the NHL team with no other revenues to help supplement all of the losses that the Thrashers are probably going to have for a long, long time.
This is the second time in Atlanta. Is the NHL ever going to rethink that Southeast idea, or do you think they'll stubbornly hang in there with Carolina, Tampa Bay, Florida, which is a team that's in and out of trouble? Do you think they'll eventually give up on that area? It seems like it's the weakest market group in the United States. Is that where these teams, if they do come back to Canada, is that where they're going to come from?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, no, probably. I mean, right now, Atlanta and then Phoenix are the most vulnerable teams. Florida is probably, in there. I had the chance to go to the Florida Panthers rink for the first time this year, and it's amazing because it's not anywhere close to Miami. I mean, it's 30, 35 minutes outside of Miami. It's right on the edge of swampland in Sunrise, which is a city of about 70,000 people. To me, going to some of these markets for the first time, it's actually incredible that they get as many fans as they do, really. I think as long as Bettman is in charge, they won't give up on the strategy because that's sort of part of his legacy. And, when talking to people around the league about what's happening with Phoenix and Atlanta, part of the reason that they're so committed to Phoenix is that Bettman is just very, very... His reputation is sort of tied up in what happens with that team, and he wants to see them stay there and flourish and sort of grow the way that the Nashville Predators have done to the point that they can be self-sustaining. They've got a favorable lease in Nashville, and they've got a fan base that's growing all the time. Bettman thinks if he can get that to happen in Phoenix eventually, that'll be a huge win for, I guess, his reputation and the strategy of moving all those teams south.
What's next for you, James, as far as the NHL calendar is concerned? Are you going to be hovering around the draft? What's your summer look like?
I'm actually doing the Memorial Cup starting on Thursday, so I'll be doing that for about a week and a half, and then I'll be following the NHL finals probably from here in Toronto and just writing stuff for our website, and then I get some vacation until free agency, so I'm looking forward to it.
Nice. James, we'll touch base with you again. Thanks so much for this.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, James Myrtle from the Globe and Mail, talking a little National Hockey League. Lots going on this week, and we touched base on a few of the major points, specifically the Phoenix situation, the Atlanta situation, a little bit about the World Hockey Championships and that crazy goal. Go to the Globe and Mail site. It's all over, actually, the Internet, but that Granlund goal was outstanding. Coming up, we'll talk to Greg Drinan from Taking Note.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Side. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 12:27. This is about week, 12 or 13 for Nation Radio, and this has to be the nicest actual day that I've been here. It's a beautiful day. Hope you're outside and enjoying it, and love that you're tuning into Nation Radio. Coming up later on in the top of the next hour, we're going to talk to Brian Sutherby, NHL player, former first-round draft pick, WHL star, and we're going to talk about the process that he went through as during his draft year and before that, and exactly what a lot of these kids are going to be experiencing at the draft and for next year as well. It's going to be a very interesting conversation. Looking forward to it. Terry Jones from the Edmonton Sun joins us now to talk a little bit about, the National Hockey League. And, when the Canucks won round one, they put up a banner. What do they do for round two now? A statue or a monument?
Well, they always start with the parade out there, so it's it's really curious to follow the fans of the Vancouver Canucks out there because they're just... a little bit different.
All kidding aside, though, they really do look like this could be the year for the Vancouver Canucks and their fans.
Well, we've been saying that right since before training camp started almost. It looks like the most complete hockey club they have, and I think we've seen that to the extent that, who would have thought at any point here that they could win with the Sedins almost being irrelevant. They've done that to this point. I suspect, to be honest with you, we're going to see the Sedins become a much larger factor in this next series because I think they'll have a little bit more room out there. But that's, I think, evidenced itself so far.
I think, and I hope you agree with me, that it's a better...
No, I disagree.
it's a better matchup for the Sedins against the Sharks than it would be against the Red Wings.
Yeah, I just think there's going to be more space, and I think there's going to be even the Red Wings they don't take the body quite to the extent that the Canucks have seen. Chicago had that game plan down from previous series, and I think the Sedins had a real difficult time playing through it. And, of course, there's nowhere to play through when you play a team like Nashville because they just clog everything up on you. So I think with a little bit of freedom, it could be actually a little bit of joy for that Swedish pair.
The Conn Smythe talk in Vancouver has surrounded Kessler. Do you see anybody else? See the Sedins doing well enough in the next two series to get back in that conversation?
No, I mean, he's just been dominant. And I think the only guy that could really do that is Roberto Luongo, who, was people almost forgot already that he didn't play in game six of the first round. And there was, considerable angst about, what he would do down the road. But if he stood on his head the rest of the way, he would certainly be in it. But, I think Kessler has basically got them here if you analyze it.
Is this Mike Gillis's club, or is it Nonis or Burke or even Tambellini, or is it a combination of all four guys over the years putting this team together and coming out and looking as good as they do?
Well, I mean, you have to start with Burke with a couple of those deals he made, drafting the Twins and putting that deal together. It certainly made them what they've been in the regular season. But at the same time, you've got Roberto Luongo has been a major, major part of that success, and he came after the fact. I think it's like most teams are. Right now, if you call this Tambellini's team in Edmonton with the Oilers, or is it half and half with Kevin Lowe's team from the past, or just what? I think there's very few teams other than the Detroit Red Wings that you can say, okay, that's his team.
Good point. San Jose, coming off of that series, do you think there'll be any kind of a letdown for them? The turnaround, I guess it's on Sunday, the first game.
Right. I think it'll be... I've seen that game so many times before, and you're kind of thinking that the team that's been kind of had a chance to put up their feet for a couple of days is a huge advantage, but so often it works the other way because the other team just kind of keeps going from where they were, and then they have their letdown in after that first game. And then, I don't think the Canucks have been off long enough we can have that rest versus rust discussion, but I don't really know what to expect. I do know what I expect overall is I think we've seen and maturity with Vancouver that is slow coming, and goodness knows both of these teams have yeah. I mean they just don't, they're not quick learners when it comes to learning their lessons, let's put it that way. But I really believe that Vancouver has a quicker learning curve right now than I think we're going to see them go from seven games to six games to five games in this series. But the one I have the biggest question mark about is game one.
Yeah, I agree. I also think that the one thing that could save San Jose is that Joe Thornton appears to be playing the best hockey of his year right now. He's playing very well.
That's true, and I'm not putting too much on what I saw with Marleau and in what he came up with in Game 7, but that's, the most he's contributed in a Game 6 or 7 in virtually his entire playoff history, so that's not a bad thing either. We always don't give very much credit for some reason to this guy in goal.
Yeah.
He hasn't lost a playoff series. I mean, he won a Stanley Cup with Chicago last year. Now he comes over to San Jose and he's won two. I mean, 6-0 in the playoffs, so I think he has to be in the conversation too. But I think what we saw against Detroit, even in winning Game 7, opened some questions there because they, and even with Thornton in that group, they were so dominant in the first period, and where did they go? I mean, they came back and good on them and all that, but I still have a lot more questions about San Jose that I'm not sold on.
Let's switch over to the Eastern Conference, and it's a series that I'm interesting matchup. I've watched the Bruins a lot this year, Tampa Bay not so much. It appears as though everybody's underrating Tampa Bay. There's still a lot of good hockey players on the Lightning.
That's true, but I'm one of those guys that's underrating them. I think there's a significant percentage of the population here that would love to see Dwayne Roloson get to the Stanley Cup final and have the experience he was cheated out of in 2006 because of injury. But I don't know that, you know, that hasn't been the, you know, the moons and the stars and the planets and all that being aligned in the right spots to get them to this point. And I just like so much what I see with the Bruins that I have a hard time picking anybody to beat them.
It'd be kind of cool if it was a final between Vancouver and Tampa Bay and Torres fell on Rolison.
Other than the travel part.
So clearly you're going to be doing some traveling.
I'm not sure yet.
I never thought of that. That's going to be... Actually, there's no chance it won't be hell for travel, right?
Well, pretty much, but, you know, it we've had a couple of those. The Oilers and Carolina was a bit of a hike, and Calgary and Tampa Bay was a bit of a hike. I still, you know, go back to when the Oilers played the Islanders in that one series, and then the Bruins in the next series, and they had the 2-3-2 setup.
Yeah.
And because the Oilers won game one, I think, in both of those series, and then came home and won games 3, 4, or 5, they decided to vote that out immediately. But if it had it worked out a little bit differently, I think that's the format you should go to. I mean, it's just so many people being moved, you know, great distances that it takes a bit of the joy out of it.
That was 84, right, Terry?
Let me see now. Yeah.
Because they won game 5 back here, Lumley scoring the
FTP. Right, yeah, that's right. And then the following year as well.
Yeah, okay. What's your take on the Phoenix situation and the council willing to pony up another 25 mil to keep the Coyotes in town?
Well, it's kind of like a poker game when you've been on, you know, you've already, you know, bet 25 and then another 25. You're kind of in it, aren't you?
Yeah, you are.
I guess a lot of businessmen would tell you it's, you know, good money after bad. Do I think that that franchise will suddenly be a thriving, you know, Canadian-type franchise? Definitely not. Have you been to that facility?
Yeah.
It's a terrific facility.
It is, yeah.
But it... seriously, it's built in the wrong place. Glendale is the problem more than it is the Coyotes. If that building were in Scottsdale, I think they might have a chance. But if you're paying $25 million a year in Glendale, Arizona, I think the least you should be able to get out of the deal is that they be called the Glendale Coyotes. That one boggles my mind.
Now, I've been watching the NHL's reaction to the Thrashers being the next one up on at the plate, and it seems as though the verbal from Daly and the NHL is completely different in terms of keeping them in Atlanta if the owner wants to sell them to an organization that wants to take them to Winnipeg.
Yeah, I mean, in Winnipeg, they were, Phoenix, they were really strong on the R. Willis to keep this team here. And they'd made some guarantees and some promises and you know, it was, I think, acting in good faith to some of the things that we've seen go on there before. But, remember with Atlanta, this is the second time at bat down there, and there's just no evidence this thing's going to take. And, you know, other than the baseball pitcher Tom Glavine, I haven't heard a lot of word from anybody that's suggesting that that there's anybody there that wants to keep this team around. You know, certainly you don't hear that in any direction from any of the media reports or anything like that. There just seems to be a general ambivalence there.
Is there a part of the Edmonton Oilers that would prefer the Winnipeg Jets not return TV money and that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, I would think that from a business point of view, you got to split up a lot of things. I'm of the opinion that it's value added, not taken away. Yeah, it might cost you a little slice here and there, but it sure adds, you know, some spice to the soup. And I think it's extremely short-sighted if you're looking at it that way. I think there's a huge number of owners and operators in the United States that doesn't want anything to do with Winnipeg because, you know, what's a Winnipeg? You know, as far as they're, if you're talking Tampa Bay and they say, you know, the Winnipeg Jets are coming to play tonight, you know, what's a Winnipeg Jet?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we've gone through that with Columbus and some of those teams as well, right? From our point of view up here in Canada, I think there's when you look at these Atlantas and the Phoenixes and you know the passions in Quebec City and Winnipeg, and the problem when they left was, well, Winnipeg was probably more than was as much of anything as the Canadian dollar, and there was just no willing owner there anymore, or in Quebec City. But those seem to exist. My biggest question with both of those markets, incidentally, is just the depth of the corporate sponsorship,
yeah,
sort of thing, and the corporate buy, because that's so much different than what it was even 10 years ago. I mean, even in Edmonton, where we don't have a lot of head offices here, but then to this day, there's still a lot of season ticket purchases here. I think that would be exceedingly difficult. And Winnipeg, we want a team. It's going to cost you $200 a ticket. Whoa, I don't want a team.
Yeah.
You know, that point of purchase 4 years after they get the team, I have major questions about. But, if you compare them to Atlanta or Phoenix, there's no comparison.
I just want him back because it'll be nice to have somebody the Oilers can beat in the playoffs.
Yeah, bring the best of threes back, or best of fives, or whatever. The best of fives, I guess.
Best of fives. We were good at that. I think you, as a writer, would love the script that could be played out at the draft, with Edmonton selecting Ryan Nugent-Hopkins, sending him back to Red Deer, where he helps win the World Juniors for Canada in Alberta between Edmonton and Calgary, then wins the Memorial Cup, and then turns pro with the Edmonton Oilers. It writes pretty well, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think it makes a lot of sense, too. This guy is... I wasn't completely sold on him, because all I saw was the size until I watched him play a couple games in that Oil Kings series and talk to the kid as much as anything. And he converted me, because I saw him get absolutely lined up and teed up by an Oil King player and just clobbered. And it was the Oil King who went down and he stood up. So I know it's just one incident, one play, but that really opened my eyes there a lot. And as much as we cringe every moment we watch the Oiler defense, having that center is something this team hasn't had, and it looks like he makes players better. So I'd be shocked if they didn't draft him at this point.
Well, and it does make sense if you're building a team up the middle. The Oilers have had so many troubles at center over the last, how many years.
Got to go back to Doug Waite, essentially.
Yeah, and I mean, things looked good in 93 or 4 when they drafted Arnott and they had Waite, but that fell apart too. So it's been a long, long time. Are you hearing anybody else in the picture, or is it the Ryan Nugent talk has taken over?
Well, it's almost the thing that makes you think that... that it's pretty much a done deal is you don't hear the other teams debating who, Edmonton's likely going to take. There doesn't seem to be a discussion there. You don't hear, most of the talk seems to be around the number 4, 5, 6, 7 area, about the debate, rather. I'm not hearing much at the top.
No. And, interesting, because what convinced me a little bit of Nugent Hopkins was Kenny Hitchcock, who's obviously seen a lot of NHL games. He's very high on him and is calling up names like Datsyuk and that sort of thing. So it's got to be something in this player that the stats don't show.
Yeah, and I think all he needs is that one other year in junior hockey to more than anything, just to grow.
Yeah, for
but
sure.
But to grow into some things, too. It doesn't hurt a player to have that international experience, I'll tell you. I mean, you can see what it did for Eberle.
Yeah, and I think, looking back, that Sam Gagner might have benefited from another season in junior, or maybe even two, right?
Well, I think the prototype should be a guy like Eberle, because... and I think people forget, too, you bring a player in that early, you're cutting down the amount of years that you may have the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And, if he's your first-round draft choice, I don't think there's any question about Taylor Hall moving in, and we obviously saw that. But and I think there's a danger here of thinking that Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is going to walk in and be Taylor Hall, even when he does enter the lineup, assuming that we're right and that's how it's going to play out. But
yeah.
But I can't wait to watch them.
No, for sure. You know, interesting, it's been a kind of a quiet period for the Oilers, but recently some Oilers, Ryan Whitney, Jordan Eberle, Sean Horkoff, Taylor Hall, have all voiced the idea that the Oilers should bring in some more veterans to for the kids to learn from. Do you think that'll happen in spades, or maybe one or two free agents or veteran players traded for this summer?
Well, I think it needs to happen. Because you've got Taylor Hall's probably the best example there, but in contrast with him and Eberle, if you take a look at Eberle, he hasn't won anything. I mean, he played with some pretty bad Regina Pat teams, but when he got to the international level and played for Team Canada, he proved himself as a winner, so you know it's there, right? And you know what's inside that kid. With Taylor Hall, he wears it on his sleeve and everybody in the stands can see it. But I think those kids need to have success, and by that I mean need to have it now. And I go way back. If you take a look at the New York Islanders back when they were a team on training wheels, you know, they had the Bossies and the Trotches and all that. They put one guy in there that I thought made such a dramatic difference in moving that team to you know, to become a much more mature team with young kids, and that was Eddie Westfall, if you remember him.
Yeah, for sure.
I think they need some Eddie Westfalls around here.
That's a really good point. Eddie Westfall, former Bruin, so I was a fan, obviously. A couple of real quick things here. You are amazing on Twitter. I cracked up this week. I think it was this week or last week. You had one line that said, I like the Edmonton FC tweets because it's game started, half an hour later, goal.
I remember one of the greatest sports writers in history, Jim Murray of the Los Angeles Times, went and covered I don't know if it was a soccer game at the Olympics or some major soccer game somewhere, and the first, maybe it was a World Cup even, I'm not sure, but the first game was 0-0. And his first paragraph on the second game he covered was a goal. I saw a goal. I actually saw a goal. And I got my own personal, I've covered several World Cups, and I'm a big fan of the game. But my personal one is the Edmonton Drillers, when they entered the original North American Soccer League, played their first two games on the road. One was in Vancouver, and one was in San Jose against the Earthquake. Then they came home and played somebody. They didn't score a goal in either of their first two away games. And they came home, and I turned around in the press box, back in the days when you could smoke in the press box, and got a light from Chris Cuthbert, who was sitting behind me. And that's when they scored. There was no rebound.
Oh, no.
So I went three games without seeing a goal. So.
Hope you enjoyed the smoke. And final question, and this is outside baseball or outside hockey or baseball or soccer. As an Edmonton Eskimo follower, I think this is the first draft they've had in years where you can actually say they went and did a great job and picked up some guys who can actually play now and for a long time. Do you agree with that?
I do, and I mean, just the fact that they ended up, you know, with two top picks. I mean, the draft wasn't even worth reporting here for the last 4 or 5 years because they didn't have any picks, you know, to do what Eric Tillman did to end up picking second and fifth, essentially first and fifth, because of what
Winnipeg
did over there. Considering, you know, what he started with here, because I mean, it was just such a mess. They had to get Taylor Inglis back, who they cut, because one of the assistant coaches, Noel Thorpe, didn't like the guy. So they gave up their sixth and fifth draft choices to get a player back that they cut, which is, you know, mind-boggling. Yeah. And then they had to make a couple of other deals, and all of a sudden they've got picks 2, 10, and 18, and they moved 18 up into 13 with a deal. You know, I have, like anybody in a draft, until you actually see the players, you have no real idea, but it, you know, talking to other people, it sounds like they got some pretty good guys here. And but just the whole idea that that they're, you know, the plan is to get back to Canadian content. I mean, you know, people think of Warren Moon and Dan Kepley and all those guys when they, you know, talk about that glory team that won five in a row here. But I'm telling you what, you go back and analyze that team, and it's the Canadian content, the depth that Frankie Morris provided back in those days before there really was a draft, or when it was, you know, a lot of territorial picks. The most important word in Canadian Football League is Canadian.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think Edmonton fans should be very happy that the Eskimos are finally getting back to that.
You know, and it's true. I remember back in those days, other teams would wait for the Eskimos to make their cuts and then sign those guys, and they'd go right into the starting lineup.
Right, and a lot of, I mean, Danny Machocha's idea was that, you know, well, let the other teams draft him, because it takes 2-3 years to train, you know, some of these Canadians to get to the same level that the, you know, that the American kids have gone through with their programs down there. Well, you know, we'll pick them off as a free agent after these guys train them. But it's you know, when you look back at that, it seems that the guy who was a, you know, I mean, he was a Canadian.
Yeah.
Put less emphasis on Canadians than anybody I've ever met.
Well, and especially when the Riders were beating the tar out of us with Canadians. That's what killed me. But better times ahead. Terry, thank you so much for this.
Always. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. It's Terry Jones from the Edmonton Sun off to Vancouver, and we'll obviously be reporting from Game 1 of the Canucks and Sharks. Coming up, we're going to have some emails and tee up next hour. Straight ahead.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
12:56, very quickly before we take another break and tee up next hour. Coming up next hour, we're going to start what we're hoping to be a fairly regular item, and that is going through the process from WHL draft, you know, you're playing midget WHL draft, right through to draft day. And then as we get closer, we'll talk a lot about draft day, but I want to really give a picture of what it's like for the player and the family. And coming up next hour, we have Brian Sutherby, the Dallas Stars, and we're going to start today and really take a journey through his time as a prospect, growing up in Edmonton, playing minor midget and playing here, and then being drafted into the WHL, and the really the journey that happened, and a lot of the inside questions and some curiosity. You can also email us if you have any questions, nationradio@team1260.com for Brian. And later on in the hour, I'll talk to Oliver Gabriel, a Columbus prospect, and we'll do the same thing. Now, he just signed in, I believe, September or October with Columbus, so his pro career is just starting, but we're going to get a little insight into exactly what goes on for these hockey players and the process, that really intense year that is the 17-year-old season. Still very young and a lot of things happening, and the state of preparedness has to be great. We're going to talk about that with Brian Sutherby and others coming up next hour on Nation Radio.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
Every week, Nation Radio focuses on Oilers past, present, and future, plus the NHL's biggest stories every week. And for Edmonton fans, the last couple of years in a row, the NHL entry draft has been the big story. Over the next few weeks, and well, really over the next while, we're going to talk, leading up to the draft, we're going to talk a little bit about the process for prospects as they enter into their 17-year-old season and begin the process of becoming draft eligible, finding out that NHL teams are interested in them, the entire, you know, 12 months that goes from the fall of your draft year through the wintertime, World Hockey Championships, the opportunity to play there, to showcase yourself, and then the NHL Combine. We're delighted to welcome to the show Brian Sutherby, NHL player. Brian, how are you?
Good, and you?
Good. Let's start. I'd like to do today is to really go through the period of time leading up until your draft, and let's start by asking this. How did you go from a 15-year-old playing for the Edmonton Athletic Club to a kid drafted 94th overall in 97's WHL Bantam Draft to being one of the highest-ranked juniors in the world 3 years later?
Yeah, it all happened pretty fast, actually. At the time, it didn't seem that way. It was a lot of fun and a great ride, and I think looking back at it now, you know, it's hard to believe how crazy a time it was and how fast it went. I guess started playing for the Canadian Athletic Club when I was 14 in Bantam, and I got drafted that year. I was pretty small. I was 5'9", like 130 pounds, and got drafted by the Moose Jaw Warriors. They told me, I got a phone call actually the next day, so I didn't think that I even got drafted. I was absolutely devastated. And then I had a huge, huge growth spurt that next year, and showed up at Moose Jaw Camp 6'2", 158, big and scrawny, and kind of went from there.
Is it difficult when you go from Dick, you're a 14-year-old kid, now you arrive in the WHL, or when you got there the first training camp with the older players, were they that much bigger than you? Was it intimidating?
Well, for me, I was pretty small. Being 150 pounds, it was certainly intimidating. But at the same time, it was all kind of a whirlwind. You grow up as a kid always dreaming to play in the NHL or dreaming to make it to that next level. But I don't know if you ever really set it as a reality or believe that it's going to happen. And so when you finally get there, it was just, I almost felt like an underdog. I felt like, this wasn't something that was supposed to happen for me. And it was a lot of fun. I was very skinny, very small, and it was tough. At first, but you grow, and it was a great time.
How long did it take in that first season in the Western Hockey League for you to really feel, like you belonged?
It's an adjustment. Obviously, anytime you're a young kid, you move to a new city and move away from your parents and family and friends that have been with you your whole time. But it was exciting. I remember my parents. We juggled with deciding whether I should go to college or play in the Western League. And for me, watching the Edmonton Ice and when they were in Edmonton, that was always a goal of mine, always a dream. And so there was, when I was told that I could make it, there was no turning back. Certainly being away from home, living with billets, it was an adjustment. A lot of homesick that first year. I was very excited to get home when the season was over, but it was just a big thrill to be able to say you played in the Western Hockey League in the greatest league that you could be at the time. It was a great honor.
When you first went to Moose Jaw, how familiar were you with road trips and time away from family by that time?
Not a lot. I mean, at that time, you're 16 years old, and most of the time you spent going to hockey tournaments and things like that on the bus with family, and there's always parents there. And that was a lot of fun. To this day, I look back at all the bus trips in junior and even in the minors. There are times that you get to spend with the boys, and they're sometimes long and painful, and you watch a lot of movies and eat a lot of crap food. But that's kind of where you grow up, and you really bond with your teammates. And those 20-hour bus rides, painful as they were, looking back, they were a hell of a time.
And WHL, I think of all the CHL leagues, is legendary for those long, long bus rides. What's the worst one that you had in your league when you played?
Probably always that trip driving back from the northern U.S. there, the Seattle, Portland, Tri-Cities, back to Moose Jaw. You never stopped. You drove right through the night, and it was always 22 hours plus. I think one year we ended up driving back from Prince George as well, and that was an absolute nightmare for sure.
How many times did you watch Slapshot as a teenager on those bus rides?
that was obvious choice for movies for most of us. It's a great hockey movie, and a lot of us, and especially myself, I enjoy those types of movies with the fighting and meatheads like that, so it's pretty funny.
Now, we're going to get into your draft season in a minute, but one more question in this particular area. When you were in Moose Jaw, there was that first season, you obviously bonded with your teammates, and that, are those relationships that continue to this day?
Yeah, I actually just went to Sean Lemprate's wedding last summer. He was my line mate for 3 years, and although I've seen him periodically over the last 10 years, but not a lot. I mean, you certainly lose touch, but those memories and those times, you can never take back, and I love those guys to death. We had great times together, and we do still keep in touch and text and whatnot, and those guys will be friends for life.
Did you get a chance to revisit the crushed can before the end of things there?
No, I you know, I actually do make it back to Moose Jaw usually about once a summer, and so obviously I have some pictures of it, and I have a big 16x20 picture of it at my house. Actually, it's one of the legendary barns in the Western Hockey League, and I'm not sure, maybe you know, I don't know if they are planning to tear it down or not, but if they do, it's certainly going to be sad.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know they're going to the new facility. I can remember many nights that joint got rocking. It really did. It was one of the best places to watch, organized hockey that I've ever seen. It was a very, very unique experience. Let's move on to your 17-year-old season. When did you begin to realize that NHL scouts might be coming to watch you play?
Probably not till I was 17. Again, going back to earlier in the conversation, it happened really fast for me. Playing Bantam AAA and then making the Western Hockey League at 16, like I said, it was a thrill and a goal of mine, but I was never really on the radar, in my opinion. Team Alberta, when we were 15, 16, I played baseball. I was obviously invited to those camps, but I was playing baseball, so I turned them down, and I don't know if maybe that had an effect on it or not, but I never did play for those teams. A lot of times that's kind of where you do get on the radar with scouts and things like that, and so I made the team at 16 and went into that summer as a 17-year-old, and that was the first summer that I really sort of took hockey more seriously. I stopped playing baseball. That's when I finally first got a trainer and started working out with a bunch of other guys that played in the Western Hockey League and started going from there. But it, again, even after my 16-year-old year, there was no real interest for me to play for Team Canada at the under-18s or under-17s, whatever it was at the time. I went into that year excited, almost just kind of thinking, you know, maybe there's a chance that I can get drafted here in the seventh or eighth round. I don't really know, looking at my numbers and things like that. You know, there should be a chance, but again, it happened so fast, and it wasn't until middle of my 17-year-old season when the Central Scouting rankings came out and kind of blew me away, I guess. But it was very cool.
I know you were. I'm going to say maybe in the top 10. Central Scouting North American skaters. Do you remember about where you were?
Yeah, I believe, I kind of do, actually. I November 26th, I remember it like it was yesterday. I was hurt in a fight, actually, and in Kamloops, and I remember my family came down and picked me up, and I went back home for a few weeks because it was a pretty bad shoulder injury, and my dad, my old man's a pretty intense guy, and I think he probably had it more on his radar than I did at the time, and he's thinking, this is going to be bad for the draft. And I remember only a few days after that, the rankings came out and kind of picked my spirits up again. I was ranked number 2 in the Western Hockey League behind Scotty Hartnell. I'm not sure completely North America. I want to say maybe 8. I think that number rings a bell, but I know that right around the end of November, the first rankings came out, and I was number 2 behind Hartnell, and it was certainly a bit surprising, shocking, and a great feeling as well.
Your scouting report from Central Scouting talked about your two-way ability and the fact that you played a very physical style. At what point did you start to really dominate or impose your physical will in the Western League? Was that during that 17-year-old season as well?
Yeah, I'd want to say even at 16, even 15, I always played the game with sort of an edge. Again, I don't know if that's something that's ingrained in me by my old man, but that's kind of the type of person that he is, and I grew up with that sort of little snarl, I guess, in the way I play. And at 16, you learn pretty quickly in that league that you got to get your feet wet, throwing the knuckles every once in a while, and got to stick up for yourself or teammates. Otherwise, especially in the Western League, you're gonna get taken advantage of. And I certainly didn't mind it. It was not something that I ever shied away from. And I knew going into my 17-year-old year that if those are things that I could do and bring to my game that would maybe separate me from someone else, that I would do that for sure.
Did you ever feel a specific NHL team was watching you or monitoring, or did anybody talk to you from an NHL team or organization during that time?
Not during the season, no, not at all. Again, it was, like I said, it happened very quickly for me. I didn't feel like I was on the radar for the longest time, and it was basically more monitoring kind of just the rankings and what Central Scouting was saying. Again, I missed a lot of time with that shoulder injury. I only played, I think, 46 or 47 games that year. I missed the prospects game, so I didn't get to really, I don't even know, to be honest, if they interact with scouts there. But, the first real experiences with scouts and things like that came once the season ended and the NHL Combine and the draft and things like that.
I know things have changed since 2000 to now, 11 years later, at the Combine. But tell me about what was your Combine experience like?
It was cool. I didn't feel a lot of pressure. Again, I felt more like an underdog. I was just kind of almost happy to be there, and it was all sort of new territory and new surroundings for me. I think highly touted kids that, are 14, 15 sort of maybe grow up with it. But for me, it was something that I'd never experienced before and really felt no pressure. I was nervous for sure, going and sitting in front of 10 NHL scouts and GMs and things like that. But it was very cool. It was very grueling and tough. And mentally, it was difficult. Obviously, you're getting grilled by a ton of teams, and your character and all those types of things are coming into question. But looking back, it was a very cool time.
Did anybody prep you? Did anybody prep you for the interviews? Let you know what might be happening.
I don't really recall at the time. I'm sure that my agent and I spoke with other players that I was training with at the time, but offhand, I don't really recall.
And then during I know that there's a lot of interviews, but there's also the physical testing. Did you take part in all of the testing?
Yeah, I wasn't able to do some of the bench press and, I guess, shoulder type things, as I was still, sort of recovering from the shoulder thing, but did the wind gate and the VO2 and vertical jump and all the sort of things. And it's I'm sure you've talked to many kids that'll tell you that it's an interesting time. There's 50, 60 scouts all staring at you wearing the skimpy little outfit and eyeballing your every move. Certainly could have been uncomfortable at times.
You know, if the world ever wanted to kill every member of the media, they should just send them to the NHL Combine and make them go through all of that, because there's no way we'd do it. But was there anything you had difficulty with?
At the time I went there, I think I was 174 pounds, so I think it was a blessing that I didn't have to do the bench press. So I think it was about 155 pounds, and there was no way in hell I would have got that bar off anyways. So that would have been extremely difficult for me. Other than that, like I said, I started with a trainer. I started probably late March, early April with a trainer, and basically geared everything towards that combine and the things you had to do to get ready for it, and I think I did pretty well there.
Brian, same general area, but talking about, the process from beginning to end, from a coaching point of view, we talked about preparing for the combine and physically. The coaches that you had leading from midget all the way through the Western Hockey League, how much of an impact did they have on the player that you became from where you were?
I think, believe it or not, mine started a lot younger. I was really fortunate at novice to play for Lee Foglin. His son played on my team, and I had Lee coaching me from the time I was a novice till I finished Pee-wee, right into Bantam. So, having him in my life, and the things that he taught me, I guess more probably on the defensive side of the game, and just being able to hear from, even a guy, I was 8, 9, 10 years old, but talking about being a professional and talking about the things that it really takes to make it one day, those things stuck with me forever. And when I got to Moose Jaw, I had Len Nielsen, who for me was another great coach. To be honest, I don't know if Lenny's even still coaching anymore, but he gave me a great opportunity, and I think that's all that it comes down to with a lot of kids, just getting your opportunity in that right spot, and you got to run with it.
You mentioned there about the defensive side of the game. I didn't think to ask you this before, but when you went to the Dub, how quickly before you were playing on special teams, PK, taking faceoffs, did that come right away, or was it a matter of time?
Yeah, that was primarily my role right out of the gate. I don't really I don't really know where that started. You know, I guess, like I said, it, you know, it was sort of ingrained in me, and I certainly hated getting scored on and always wanted to sort of be a penalty killer. I enjoyed those types of things, and they're not always fun, and you don't get a lot of accolades for them, but I enjoy that type of thing. And, you know, I don't know if my coach at 16, again, just saw certain instincts with me or whatnot, but he had me PKing when I was 16 and kind of developed me into that sort of two-way forward.
Brian, it's been an education, and we reserve the right to call you back in a few weeks, but thank you so much for your time.
Sounds good. Look forward to it, and we'll talk to you again.
All right. Brian Sutherby, NHL player of the Dallas Stars, and talking a little bit, we're gonna go through the process. Next time we'll talk about the draft and leading up to the draft and the selection. But the idea is, you know, I've been a hockey fan since the 60s. I remember watching it, and going through that with him, I find it fascinating, because the bottom line is these kids are, he said it himself, he was, you know, a very young man when he left home, and this is the pursuit that he wanted to go with, and it sounds like his dad knew even before he knew, you know, where he was headed, sort of thing. And there's a lot of dedication, not just from Brian Sutherby, but from the family, and I think he got that in coaching. And it's an interesting, it really is an interesting conversation to have, and I thank him very much for that, because I learned a whole lot. It's 21 minutes after the hour, and we've got more Nation Radio coming up.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
We are Nation Radio. You can email us at nationradio at theteam1260.com. It's Alan Mitchell, Low Tide, along with Connor, and we are here until 2 o'clock today. And we invite your emails at nationradio at team1260.com. Lots going on. Of course, the semifinals begin tonight. Tampa Bay at Boston, game one of the Eastern Conference semifinal. I think it's going to be an interesting series. The reasons behind it are there's a lot of stories that involve the Edmonton Oilers, specifically with Tampa Bay, Rolison, backstocking the Lightning to, I think, what a surprise. Final Four appearance. Marc-Andre Bergeron is also on the team, and that's kind of interesting, you know, in a really morose sort of way. And you know what? Tampa Bay is a kind of a mixture of old and new. There's still St. Louis, Le Cavalier there as well, Ryan Malone, some older vets, and then the younger group like Steve Stamkos. It's going to be an interesting series from their end. Boston, I think, will carry the day just because it's a team that has, you know, outstanding power forwards, as good a goaltending as Dwayne Rolison has provided for Tampa Bay. If anything, Tim Thomas has done better in the Boston net. They're mature, they're veterans, they got Chara. I think Boston's year to go to the Stanley Cup final. And tomorrow night in the West, we're talking about San Jose and Vancouver, and I really do believe that a lot of Edmontonians, not a matter of jealousy, I think it's just a matter of being so close to Vancouver and hearing Vancouver fans over and over again in years where, you know, they got bounced in the quarterfinals where they were bragging, that if Vancouver does win it, it'll be, you know, respect and all that sort of thing. But there's some bad blood between Canucks fans and Oilers fans. That's all I'm saying. We are Nation Radio. We're pleased to be joined by Oliver Gabriel, Columbus Blue Jackets prospect. Oliver, how are you, man?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Good. It's your birthday today.
It was yesterday, actually.
Okay. Happy birthday.
Yeah, thank you.
You're 20 now, right?
Yeah, just turned 20.
So have you looked up a number of states and provinces you're legal in now to do anything?
No, I think I've been just about legal in everywhere in Canada, I think, past year.
Yeah, I think you're good. You're good to go. You know what? Yeah. It's we just talked to Brian Sutherby. We're going to do a lot of the same conversation that we had with him. Only his draft year was 2000. Your draft eligible year was 2009, right?
Yeah.
Take me through that season. When were you aware that scouts were in the stands and they were observing you, and there was some interest in Oliver Gabriel?
Well, I mean, I played as a rookie in the league as a 17-year-old, and I wasn't playing much. That was my first year of eligibility. But, you know, that year was kind of a write-off NHL-wise. But, yeah, my 18-year-old year, four games in, I lacerated my spleen in a game. So I missed about 3 months of that season. And after that, I came back and just had a really good playoff. And right in the playoffs is when I kind of started getting interest from guys, you know, my agent calling me about camp invites and stuff like that, you know, in the second round of the playoffs. So that was pretty exciting.
Now, that would have been 2010 spring, right?
Yeah, that was probably my first year of really, you know, NHL prospects, right?
Now, were you aware of, was your agent telling you specific teams that had an interest in you?
Yeah, during the playoff run. We were in the second round against Vancouver. And, yeah, so it would have been last year. Last season, he called me and said the Oilers invited me to their development camp, which would be, you know, it would have been, I think, middle of the summer, right?
Yeah, July, yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, I was going to go to that. You know, I said, yeah, I'll go. And I was about the only team that showed interest until the day of the draft. And then it got a little more interesting, but I just ended up going to Columbus.
Now, what same, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead. Well, to the same development camp, but they offered the Traverse City Prospects Tournament on top of it, whereas Edmonton didn't offer their exhibition tournament, so I decided to go with Columbus. You know, I had a guaranteed second look.
Well, Columbus may have been a team that had been looking at you for a while because, obviously, Ryan Johansson played on the same team as you did during that season.
Yeah, actually, when I came back from that injury, it was right around the time, right after Christmas, so guys like Nino and who else would have been gone? I don't know, we had a few guys gone at, you know, international tournaments, so I came back and just went right onto a line with Johansson and Brad Ross, and we ended up having a really good month of January. I think Brad got player of the month, and I was on his line the whole month. So I think they probably had a pretty good look at me kind of throughout the second half of the season.
Now, leading up to draft day, you had to know that you were in the mix. I can tell you that as somebody who's been following the draft for 35 years, kids today are a little bit unfortunate, and the draft is only about 6 rounds. Back in the olden days, they used to go 15 rounds, and it was endless. I mean, you could be a 15th round pick and not actually go to training camp. So I think one of the reasons they cut down the rounds is that they could do what the Columbus Blue Jackets did with you, is get you after the draft and have you come in and have a look at you at that time. Now, you signed with Columbus early fall or late summer?
Early fall.
Okay.
It was right at the start of the season with Portland.
Now, when you were following draft day and finding out where everybody was going, were you excited? Did you feel good for Johansson and all those other guys?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was a huge day for those guys. And, you know, just it was great for the team. You know, we had to have that many guys get drafted and got some good exposure for us, and obviously having the season we had this year, you know, obviously it was a tough loss for them last night to talk to a few guys. But yeah, I mean, it was great to see that, especially for them to go so high. I mean, I don't think neither of them really expected to go top five with Ryan and Nino, but it was great to see them go, you know, unexpectedly early, and, you know, and I think they've both shown that they deserve to be where they are right now.
Now, when Columbus decided that to sign you, was after, obviously, the tournament and the experience that you had with the Blue Jackets.
Yeah, like I said, I went to the development camp and the exhibition tournament, which would have been, I think, right before NHL's training camp.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, it was pretty much, I was going to the tournament, and there were no guarantees after that, and I pretty much played my way into training camp. They said, you know, you're the only free agent forward that's coming to training camp. So I go into there against all the NHL guys, and, you know, for whatever reason, I think I was just feeling good and confident. I just had a great training camp there, and next thing I know, I'm playing, like, flying to Atlanta on a chartered jet and playing a game there, an exhibition game. And then I ended up just kind of kept going from there. I scored in that game and then ended up playing another game in Pittsburgh against, you know, Sidney Crosby, Malkin, and Fleury and all those guys. It was a crazy experience.
You know, combining your final 2 years of junior, it's about a full season, and you're a 20-plus goal scorer, 56 points, but you've got size and grit. Do you see yourself playing, like, on a checking line, or do you think you've got enough skill to play on a skill line in the pro level?
I mean, for my junior career, I've been, you know, kind of all over the place, especially under Mike Johnson, you know. I've kind of been his guy that can play on any line, any night, you know. If I need to play 20 minutes, I could. If I need to play, you know, 8, you know, some nights is the way it was. So, I mean, it's tough to say. I don't really know what my role would be in pro hockey yet. Like, you know, I'm going to have to try and develop it my first few seasons to see how I play and stuff like that.
Now, talk me through this year. You played 41 games with the Winterhawks. When did you get hurt?
I'm trying to remember the first time my shoulder, it just kind of slid out of its joint and come back in. Would have been, you know, I think the first time it happened was in training camp for Portland, but it wasn't too bad. And then it came out probably early in the season, you know. Kept back in. I just kind of rehabbed it. And then, you know, it was about 2 weeks after each other, you know, I think the one was in a bit of a scrum, and I just went to throw a punch, and my shoulder came out. And then the next time I got hit from behind, and my shoulders went to the boards awkwardly, and it came out again. And that was when, you know, I kind of knew I had to shut it down because it wasn't staying in. I couldn't play with it, you know.
Is this the first time you've had that problem with that shoulder, or?
Yeah, this was the first year, yeah.
Yeah. Now, this is a tough question to ask you, but how difficult was it for you to watch that great run that your teammates had and not to be there helping them out?
Oh, you know, 100%. It was a tough call because, I mean, obviously Mike Johnston and Travis Green, they didn't want me to get surgery, right? They'd rather I try and, you know, play through it, play with a brace on my shoulder and, you know, make a run of it. But there wasn't a guarantee that my shoulder was going to last. You know, for who knows how long, right?
And then it could cost you 2 years, right?
Exactly. My whole summer, you know, I'm spent rehabbing instead of training because I'm going to be trying to make the pro team next year. So I pretty much had to make the call, you know, on my own with my parents. You know, Columbus was involved a bit. You know, they just, obviously, they had their interest in mind and Portland had their own interest in mind. So it was just pretty much left up to me what I think was best for me. And in the end, you know, my coaches in Portland were really good about it and they just said, you know, like it's an injury. It's the way it is. We're disappointed we can't have you, but you know, it was probably the right move to get surgery when I did instead of trying to wait it out.
Absolutely, you don't want to cost yourself another season, especially when you go into a pro camp and you've got a chance to. Tell me a little bit about Columbus. Do they have an ECHL team? Do they have that safeguard? If you turn pro, can you play at what would be, I guess, the hockey equivalent of Double A?
No, they don't. They have their AHL team in Springfield. And then I think they have because I know of a few players that got sent down to Fort Wayne, which I believe is in the Central Hockey League.
Okay.
So I know they've had a few prospects playing there this year. And I mean, obviously, my goal this year, for me personally, I'd love to make the AHL. I mean, I think making Columbus next year, you know, it'd be great, but I just, you know, realistically, I'm aiming for the AHL, and I think that's what their plan is for me, too, is to hopefully play my way onto the AHL team and kind of go from there, right?
Yeah, Columbus is a very good organization. They've developed a lot of quality players by them going down and playing in the American Hockey League level. Did that sway you at all, the fact that they have had success and they have, I guess, remained true to their prospects? They do develop them and then move them up to the big leagues?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of good things about that organization, especially their director of player development, Tyler Wright. You know, he's great to have. You know, you can just, you know, anytime you got to text him about anything you want to know, you know, he'll get back to you right away. You know, he communicates well with the younger guys and stuff. And, you know, it's guys like him to have around. You know, they're really good. And when you're first starting out your pro career, right?
Yeah. Oliver, do they give you some kind of a training regimen for you, especially with your injury, some things that they have expectations-wise before you get to camp in the fall?
Yeah, they sent out, you know, a summer, like a package, just their summer program. You know, it's got a big booklet with training exercises that I could do. And, you know, they never told me I had to do them. Like, if I want to go to my own trainer that I've been with for a few years, I could do that. But, you know, I think, you know, they sent a good booklet out. You know, it's really descriptive. And it pretty much says, you know, how to eat, how to act, you know, how to take care of your body properly and stuff like that.
If I were in your position, I would be on the Columbus Blue Jackets site looking at their depth chart at my position. Have you done that?
Actually, I haven't. You know, I've never really been that way. You know, just trying to worry about someone you need to be playing better than, you know. Like, for me, I went to that camp just pretty much I had no expectations. No one was expecting great things from me, you know. So I just went in and said, you know, I'm just going to play and try and have fun, you know, and just kind of play without fear of, you know, messing up or anything like that. You know, it's expected at those camps.
Enlisting?
So, yeah, like, I never really checked the depth chart. You know, I'm just planning on going to camp and just doing what I did last year, just go play. Wherever I end up is where I end up, you know.
Enlisting to you talk about that camp, it sounds like it did a lot for your confidence. You really feel like you can play at that level.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for me, playing junior, my coaches always get on me for not, you know, having confidence with the puck. But going into that camp, you know, it really did help my confidence just because I realized myself, like, you know, I can play with these guys. Not a big deal. You know, like, for me, it was just people put the NHL on such a pedestal. But for me, I've never really realized I was that close to that pedestal, you know?
Mm-hmm. When you go to camp this fall, and we're, you know, paying attention and watching you play, do you feel as though, you know, the longer you stay in camp, that's a good sign?
I would say so, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the longer you're there, closer you are to regular season, I think the harder of a decision you're making them make, right? Obviously, if it was an easy decision, they'd have made it a little while ago, and if they're still thinking about it, you know, 5 or 6 days before the NHL season opens, then, you know, obviously then they're debating, you know, whether or not, what they're going to do with you at the time, right?
How much has the coaching that you had at the minor league level impacted how the player that you are now, and then through the WHL as well with the coaching?
Oh, I mean, growing up, I had some pretty good hockey coaches, but once I got to junior, and, you know, I was, like, extremely lucky to have, you know, Mike Johnson and Travis Green as my coaches in junior, because, I mean, they caught me at a perfect age, and Travis and Mike, they really worked with me. Told me the player, you know, they developed me into the player I am today for the most part. You know, they've taught me a lot of great things over the past 3 years.
Oliver, what's your scouting report? If I was going to ask you what kind of player you are in two sentences, what would you say?
You know, that's a pretty tough question, you know, to kind of say something about yourself. But for me, like, I've always been, you know, a guy that likes to hang on to the puck in the corners, you know, protect the puck, play with energy, you know, I'll fight if I have to, you know, I won't fight 20 times a year, but, you know, 5 or 6 times if I need to. So, I mean, I could see myself, you know, a third or second line guy, you know, just kind of playing with energy.
Good stuff. Oliver, thanks so much for this. We appreciate it so much.
All right, yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay. Oliver Gabriel, Columbus Blue Jackets young prospect and someone that the Edmonton Oilers had an interest in. You can see why. Very well-spoken young man, knows who he is. I like that he didn't look at the depth chart. I'm an old guy. I'm like, okay, who's there? You know, he doesn't worry about that stuff. He just worries about what's going on with him. It was a good conversation with a very nice young man. This is Nation Radio. We'll be back right after this.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Brought to you by The Pint, Oodle Noodle, and OilersNation.com.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
1:47, we're with you for another 13 minutes, and then it's live at Gretzky's at the top of the hour here on Team 1260 Radio. I mentioned this a little while ago, I guess this the start of the show. What we want to do is here at Nation Radio is have your input on this year's top 10 selections in the NHL entry draft. So you can email us at nationradio@theteam1260.com. You don't have to do it now. You can do it leading up to the draft. We're cool. That will give out the prize the week after the draft. But we want you to correctly identify the top 10 in order. Now, I know that's difficult, but, you know, the idea is we'll give you a really cool prize if you do. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be talking to some former NHLers and some prospects about, the draft. And we're also going to have some experts in to give their top 10s or even their first round of this year's NHL entry draft. And that'll include some media guys and some folks who do this online and do it very successfully online. Kirk Ludicky, a gentleman I introduced you to not long ago. So we want your top 10 in order, and I can say you can send any time from today right through until draft day. Obviously, anything after 5 o'clock on draft day, we're not going to include. And you can also include what you'd like as a prize. A trip to Disneyland is unlikely, but maybe an Oilers jersey signed by someone, or, you know, a year's supply of, I don't know, Cheese Whiz, something like that. Whatever you want. We're going to get Wanye from Oilers Nation to go out and find it for you. So it's kind of a make-work project for Wanye. And I thought, I'm going to post this a little bit later on, probably tomorrow morning, on the Oilers Nation website. But I thought I'd get it started. I'm going to do an early top 30 for Oilers Nation tomorrow. So my top 10 goes like this, and I wanted to preface it by talking about Garrett Joyce's wonderful scouting book, Future Greats and Heartbreaks. He describes exactly what a top 10 looks like to an NHL team. It's an 18-year-old who should develop into a first-line NHL player, maybe an all-star, definitely someone who can contribute to a winning team. Not every season has 10 top 10s. 2003 had more than 10 top 10s, if that makes sense. And last year, there were only 7 or 8. And some of them, like Jeff Skinner, didn't become obvious as top 10s until the season began. So with that in mind, here's my top 10, and I encourage you to send yours in to OilersNation at theteam1260.com. At number 10, I have Mark McNeil, the Western Hockey League power forward, the center. He's 6'1", 204. He plays. He's big center. A very, very big center. Plays big and has two-way skills. There's a lot to like there. He's very disciplined on the right side of the pocket lot and pays attention to detail. Under the radar for most of the year, he impressed enough at the under-18s to be considered a legit top 10 selection. In many ways, his scouting report reads very much like Brian Sotheby's. We talked to him earlier about his draft year. At number 9, I have Sven Barchi. He's a little undersized. You saw him play for Portland Winterhawks in the WHL playoffs and certainly in the finals. Got terrific skill. Being undervalued by some, I think people forget that he is a pure WHL rookie. This was his first year, had an exceptional year, and his impressive showing during the playoffs appears to have cemented his status as a top 10 pick on a lot of lists that you'll see right now. Looking forward to red lines coming out in the next few days, and I suspect that Barchi might be part of the top 10 there. At number 8, I have Dougie Hamilton, big defenseman from the OHL, can skate very well, has a major impact on his team's power play. I nicked him a little bit because I don't think his offense will come with him to the NHL because he won't get a lot of power play time. Almost no matter who you are in junior hockey, when you turn pro, it's very unlikely, especially as a defenseman, that you're going to have a lot of power play minutes. So Hamilton's even strength numbers aren't that impressive, even though I think he's a great big defenseman. I think you have to nick him a little bit just based on the fact that there's some really quality offensive forwards. Now, at number 7, I have Ryan Murphy, and he is a defenseman, and he is somewhat one-dimensional, but what a dimension. He's an exceptionally talented puck mover. His lack of size for the position he plays and some questions about his strength are the only real negatives. He could be the best defenseman in this draft, and I think he's the kind of prototype puck-moving defenseman that NHL teams have been looking for post-lockout. I always think of Brian Rafalski, although I don't know if he's that good defensively, but that kind of guy who's almost like a derivative. Back in the olden days, they could play forward or defense. I think Ryan Murphy's that guy, and somebody's going to take a chance on him. Probably Minnesota will trade up to take him, or Columbus, or Nashville. They seem to have all the good, really good defensemen coming out of the CHL. Number 6, I have Jonathan Huberdeau. He's going a lot higher on many lists. In fact, some have him in the top 3 or 4. I have him lower than many of the mock drafts or seedings, but Huberdeau is on an exceptionally talented team, and his offensive numbers, I think, may have been inflated a little bit courtesy of the quality of that team. It's incredible how many really good draft eligibles are on that one team. We're likely to see him, although it's still not decided, in the Memorial Cup this year. He's a talent, no doubt. I just like 5 kids better, and here they are. At number 5, Gabriel Landeskog, 6'5", 205, right now as a teenager. The one guy in the draft that I have a hard time putting at number 5 because he really deserves to go higher, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if he does. He has a nice range of skills, and that has a high value. He's a difficult player to play against. He's a leader. He's tough, and because of the wide range of skills, he's certainly worth a lottery pick, and he could go very high. I wouldn't be surprised to see him taken in the top 3, especially after the combine, because if you've heard him speak or heard scouts talk about him, he's a mature player. He could be a plug-and-play player at 18 years old, and that doesn't happen very often, and certainly not in this draft. At number 4, I have Adam Larson. He's 6'3", 220, big defender, already a seasoned pro in the SEL. I have him at 4 because it's likely Larson won't be a major offensive contributor based on how he's been used in the Swedish Elite League. Despite having a lot to recommend him defensively, I don't think he's as valuable as the men above him. And the top 3, if you've been following my mock drafts, there's a little bit of a change here. At number 3, I have Ryan Strome. 6'3", 183. He's a dynamic offensive player with a motor that won't stop. Took a massive step forward this season. A lot of those who follow the draft believe that's a huge indicator of future success. Excellent skater, soft hands, sees the ice well, and he has decent size. Doesn't have a lot of flaws to his game, and it's ridiculous how much he improved season over season. And from Landeskog back, but including Strome, I wouldn't be surprised if any of the top five were chosen number one overall by the Edmonton Oilers. At number two, Sean Couturier, a huge center, had a wonderful season again, delivered eye-popping numbers compared to the rest of the team. Kirk Ludicky loves him, wrote that it's not a major flaw in terms of his skating, and it is correctable. And number one, I moved Ryan Nugent-Hopkins to number one overall. Bob McKenzie says 6 out of 10 scouts have him at number one. Ken Hitchcock raves about him, and Craig Button told me you can't trade for these guys, and they don't show up in free agency. So Ryan Nugent-Hopkins is number one on the list. I'll be posting it probably either in the next hour or tomorrow morning on Oilers Nation. This was a great day. I enjoyed it so much. Ryan Sutherby, Oliver Gabriel, James Myrtle, Terry Jones, enjoyed them very much. We'll be back on the radio live, of course, Saturday, noon to 2, every Saturday here on Team 1260. Email us at nationradio@team1260.com. For my producer, Connor, this is Alan Mitchell, Low Tide, saying have a great week, and we'll see you on Saturday.